Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and the unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us through tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio. Coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Tonight, I decided we would do... We just sit and talk. We don't do that often. Oh, I tell stories and I do this and that and the other, but rarely do we just sit and talk. You know, over the years, all the things I've done have tended to put me out in front of other people. And... you know, when I was commissioned, I was told, well, you know, you need to be a role model for others. And I always thought that was interesting. I mean, I wondered who would pay attention to anything that I was doing. But, you know, that's certainly... There's always somebody who can't seem to figure out how to do their own life, and they have to copy someone else. And I used to watch in amusement as those who had no imagination or no creativity used to steal, because that's what it is, steal the ideas of... others. And I never thought that much about it. Well, interestingly enough, I've always heard imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. And I have, frankly, I've become the most flattered person that I know. Question about the webcam, and yeah, it's giving me problems tonight. The camera is working just fine. It's the system doesn't want to go online, and that there we go. It seems, you know, when I started doing my paranormal show, and I've been doing it off and on for 20 years. My first show went on the air in 1989. And I never paid that much attention to what others did. And I've had Coast to Coast, I'll do a show tonight. Two or three nights, they'll do the same show, sometimes with the same guest. But it was, George and I go way back. And what he did was never malicious. We just both happened to be doing the same type of shows. I started out up against Art Bell. And Art Knock had kind of a friendly rivalry. Build it up one more time. And then I started doing ghost tours here about 10 years ago. Did my first ones while I was still general counsel of a corporation here in town. It's when very few people are aware that for a long time I was an attorney until I retired. And people laughed at me. Look at that fool over there chasing ghosts and doing ghost tours. And I wasn't the first one to do them in El Paso. I make no bones about that. Joanne Shaw and Connie Wang started doing ghost tours, 20 years ago. And when I started doing them, I made sure everyone knew that I first heard stories from them. And then I started researching. And when they phased out, I went from doing them every once in a while to doing them routinely. And I had joined a local reenactment group because I do love Western reenactment, and I've always been into to weapons and what have you. But I discovered that a lot of the folks I had to deal with had never gotten beyond the stage of being the kid on the block that thought they ought to be in charge. Now, I came in the reenactment group some years after it started. And I've been in a lot of groups over the years. But I've never seen one that was organized to be a cult, where one or two people were in charge of everything. But that's pretty much how it was. A lot of them are getting long in the tooth and are reliving their younger days. In some of the reenactments, when they do John Wesley Hardin's funeral, Hardin's mistress was about 19 or 20, and the woman doing it's got to be in her late 60s. And she refuses to step down. That's her part. Now, when I started doing the ghost tours at Concordia, the only ones that ever went to Concordia, as far as I'm aware, were those who had family buried there. And I made people aware of it. And I made sure that when I did my write-ups, because I've written 40-some-odd books, I've written a lot of the ghost stories of El Paso and Fort Bliss. I never tried to own history. Well, there are those that believe they do own history. And they've gone to great lengths to try to make anyone who has written anything about the areas they think they own, such as Concordia Cemetery, they want them to donate everything they make to them. Though they couldn't write a book at gunpoint, and certainly they don't have the imagination to create something like a ghost tour. But I created it. It was as I got closer to what was going to be my retirement. It was something I could do and rather than sit around the house and watch TV. And then when they realized that I wouldn't go say yes sir, three bags full, and I've never said that to anybody. They brought in somebody to be my competition. And I heard one of his so-called ghost tours, and it was like listening to somebody read one of my books, because he's never had an idea of his own either. And it, my attitude is, you do your thing, I'll do mine. And the problem is, they're not happy trying to compete. They want everything oriented in their direction. They want everything done their way because they're somehow special. I was doing a Concordia Ghost Tour. He had to do one. And then he wasn't happy just competing. He started locking up the cemetery so only his group could come in. And they had some of their little goons at the gate. Last year they had links of iron pipe. They were going to put me in my place. A couple of folks tried to put me in my place are still laying in the jungle. Don't get up in my face and try that. I've had about all I'm going to take. And as I made clear in front of county commission when I had to take this crew there, I may be disabled, but on my worst day, they wouldn't have a prayer. And I made it clear. If attacked again, and I was attacked by these clowns, and I opted not to respond, if attacked again, I will put them down. Don't try me. And as if it wasn't enough that he has to do, try to copy what I do at the cemetery, he's now doing his own downtown tours. Interestingly enough, those who've been on both tours tell me that his tour sounds remarkably like my tour. So it, and his little group is always sending out press releases. They've joined with this group, and they've joined with that group, and they've joined with this other group. On the surface, that looks impressive. But in actuality, all these different groups that he's joining with are little groups he made up. He's bragged to people that he's a celebrity. He's a star. He's a bozo. Dresses like me. Introduces himself as me. He's worked hard to gain the epitaph of mini-me, which is what he will always be. Even copied me starting a radio show. Of course, his idea of good radio is leaves a great deal to be desired. Now, all that having been said, understand that there will be no more issues. Stay out of my path. You want so hard to be a big fish in a small pond, and this is an extremely small pond, let me assure you. It It's sad someone has such a limited imagination. They have to steal what someone else creates. And he's not the only one. I saw a film not too long ago that was taken almost entirely from one of my books. I wish you people would get a life and hanging on somebody else's coattails doesn't make you competent to step into that person's shoes. If you can't handle it on your own, you don't have a prayer. Now, I do want to make mention of the fact that this hour is brought to you by Marcello's Ristorante Italiano. They've got two locations, the original at 1300 Lee Trevino in the town, in the Sun Point Shopping Center, and the second one is 5380 Mesa in the Festival Crossing Shopping Center. Both are a touch of old Italy, and the food is some of the best Italian food you ever put in your mouth. The ambiance is very nice as well. Now, tonight, as I said, we're just going to sit and gab. We're going to sit and talk. Got a lot of questions that have been asked over the email. Now, I've had many people ask me why I haven't done ghost tours lately. And have you ever watched kids on a playground when, if one can't be in charge, he tries to make sure that nobody else can have fun either? Well, we got some of that going on in this town. And even people with absolutely no business being involved in it seem to get involved in it. And there's also a few laws being broken in the process, some of them federal. Now, it's interesting that Mini-Me made it clear to me the last time I saw him, which was one time too many, that he listens to my show every night. I guess he has to know what he's going to say on his show. We're going to make transcripts available in the near future. You can buy them for few dollars a piece, and that way it'll make it easy for you to read my stuff on your show. And if you get any idea that I am just absolutely fed up and disgusted, got a good idea. Now, you know, there's, for those who want to take the time to do their own research, and I seem to be one of the few that does that, there are all kinds of stories of strange and unusual activities that make great radio instead of cussing and laughing at people and playing the fool. There's a time and a place to play the fool. Unfortunately, these people don't seem to have figured that out yet. You know, there's a story I came across. There are those that believe in miracles, and there are those that are absolutely positive that such things are impossible. There was a lady who, this happened to her back in the 70s, as I understand. There were two trees on her lakefront property that blocked her neighbor's view. And let's face it, when you buy a lakefront property, one of the reasons you buy it's for the view. So a friend of hers offered to cut them down. Now, I've cut down a few trees in my time. That's not the easiest thing to do. Sometimes you take out porches by accident, sometimes cars. Well, the lady and her neighbor were standing watching while the friend cranked up his chainsaw, went down to the first tree, and you're supposed to notch him. And if you notch the tree, that kind of gives it an indication of which way it's supposed to fall. And it also tells you which way, which side of the tree not to be on when it falls. Well, the first tree fell right in the lake. No problem whatsoever. Got ready to do the second tree, and apparently he is feeling a little overconfident, I guess you could say, because he didn't notch this one. He just cut straight through it. Well, the two watching realized that tree was going to split instead of fall. And while they were watching, the tree did break into two parts. One part fell in the water, and the other part was still there. But he was determined, and he started sawing again. And that second part of the tree, instead of falling away from the cutter, fell on the cutter. In fact, it fell straight down onto his head. Well, now what happened next was witnessed by several people. A translucent figure came out of the body of the person telling the story and went down to the slowly floated down to where the body was laying. And then faded away. A few seconds later, the apparently dead man put his hands on the trunk and pulled his head out between the tree and the stump. Well, the two people watching rushed down and grabbed him, and he was a tad shaken up, but they didn't see any blood. There didn't seem to be any cuts or scrapes. And he didn't want to go to the hospital. So they took him home, and some of the insurance kept an eye on him. Well, the following weekend, they were back at the cabin. And a professional lumberjack had been called in to finish removing that particular tree. Had to cut it into pieces so it could be hauled out. The cap with the guy had been wearing the previous week was still caught between the stump and the tree. And when they pulled it out, it was full of blood and hair. And, you know, a little skin. Even though there had been no mark on the body, or on the individual they thought was dead. Was that a miracle? Perhaps. But many instances like that happen that are best considered miracles. You know, there have been a number of people who told stories about being transported to another location. Whether it's transported to another dimension or another being stepping out of time, I mean, there's any number of things you can call it. But the interesting thing is, occasionally they're verified by witnesses. One of the best known comes from a young lady in 1934. And she and her boyfriend had gone to a music store. This was in Chicago, and a number of these stories come out of Chicago. And I've heard a number of stories from various people that say that Chicago seems to be a window area where it's possible to go to other dimensions. Now, they had gone to a music store. They were dating. She was with her fiancé, or soon-to-be fiancé. And it was supposed to meet his parents for dinner, but while they had a free afternoon, they wanted to go listen to some of the new music that was coming out, because both were very serious music students. So they took the elevator up to the top floor, and they were studying some of the latest musical scores. And the girl had started reading a magazine, and she was pretty engrossed in it until the boyfriend pointed out it was almost time for them to be heading for his home to meet his parents. So they both returned to the elevator, and since it was almost closing time, the elevator was packed. And in the crush of the people, they got separated, and the fiancé got off on the ground floor, but the girl got pushed to the rear of the elevator and couldn't get off. So the elevator went down to the basement, where the elevator operator, now this was back in the days when elevators had operators, and I remember that well. They had a little stool right there by the buttons, and whatever they said was law. You did what the elevator operator said, and the elevator operator told everybody to get off in the basement. Well, when she stumbled through the door out into what should have been the basement, she found herself in a basement full of crates and boxes. And it didn't appear to be the basement of a downtown office building. There were men pushing carts or... they were riding on little trucks loaded down with boxes, shifting them from place to place. And all of them ignored her. She tried to stop some to ask where she was, and none of them paid any attention. So over the corner, she spotted a large iron staircase that went up to what she thought was a fire escape. And she could see daylight up above, so she followed the stairs up, and she came out on the sidewalk. But when she hit the sidewalk, she couldn't see the store she'd been in. Nothing was where it should have been or what it should have been. She was in a railroad station. Now, there have been a number of very strange stories about what people refer to as the depot. And those who've stepped across time or into another dimension quite often report finding themselves in the railroad station. And crowds of people were rushing to and fro, and she saw signs to trains, waiting room, lunch counter, tickets. And she was so engrossed in trying to see all the sights that she almost ran over one woman who just picked herself up and walked on. In spite of the fact that it appeared to be a railroad station, she didn't see any sign of trains arriving or leaving. And then she heard an announcer's voice coming over the intercom making some statement about something, like most announcers' voices, she couldn't understand it. She had no idea what was being talked about. But she wandered around until she saw an information booth and had a long line going up to where the young lady sat dispensing information. So she got in line, and when it came her turn to ask her question, the girl ignored her, looked right through her, talked to the person behind her. And that was the last straw. She was so confused and baffled that she hurried away. She needed to get outside. Then she saw a sign that said to 7th Street, and she went outside into the open air and still had no idea where she was at. Nothing looked familiar, and she'd been born and raised in Chicago. It was a beautiful day. The sky was blue. There were a few clouds in the sky. And there was a new red brick building across the street from the train depot. Didn't look familiar to her. She tried to stop passersby, but they ignored her. She could hear voices as they talked to each other, but couldn't understand the word they were saying. And she was absolutely at her wit's end. And then she noticed a blind boy in his teens standing in the center of the sidewalk, looking around in total confusion. And as she got to him, she moved out of his path to go around him, and he smiled and reached out to touch her to see if she was real. And he said, I guess they let you off at the wrong stop too. Both were in the same situation. Both found themselves in a place they just did not understand. He said he was playing tennis near his home, and he went to the locker room to change, and when he came out, he came out in the train depot. And she said, well, where's home? He said, Lincoln, Nebraska. Well, she started her trip in Chicago. So they started comparing notes, and neither one could figure out how they got there. And after a while, the street got less crowded, and the road sloped downhill, and pretty soon they were out in the country. And they saw a lake. And they went down to the shore and sat down on the rocks. They were trying to figure out, how to get home. And as they sat there, they suddenly heard voices. And one was calling her by name. And when they looked, they saw not too far out was a sandbar. And standing on the sandbar was her fiancé's sister and a couple of friends. And they all waved and shouted, and the boy said, I'm going to swim out there. It's not that far. And he jumped in the water and he started swimming, and no matter how hard he swam, the sandbar was not getting any closer. And finally, he came back, totally discouraged. And then the sandbar seemed to recede and the people faded from view. There was no fog. There was no reason for the sandbar to disappear, but it just faded away. Well, the girl was really starting to get upset when suddenly she found herself in complete and total darkness. She felt that she was floating in space. And the next thing she knew, she was back sitting on a stool in the music store. The magazine that she had been reading was right there in front of her on the counter. The clerks around her were tidying up the store, getting ready to close, and She looked around for her fiancé, but he wasn't there. So she decided the best thing she could do was go to his house and see if he had turned up there. But this time she took the stairs. When she got to his house, he opened the door and looked very relieved. He said he'd lost sight of her in the elevator. And after getting off on the first floor and realizing she wasn't with him, he tried to find her, but he never could. He figured she'd gotten off on another floor, and he went from floor to floor and couldn't find her. And finally, he decided to go home, and maybe she'd turn up. The rest of his family were already at the dinner table, and when the two entered, there sat the fiancé's sister and the same friend she had seen on the sandbar. And what they saw were the two of them walking down the other side of the street. But even though they yelled and yelled and yelled and waved, they paid no attention to them. Now, that story has been told and retold and retold since the 1930s. There's another one that comes from Paris, France. Now, this was in the early 40s. The young lady got on the elevator to go down. This was in occupied Paris. And though she pushed the button for the first floor, the elevator went to the basement and then to a sub-basement. When the door opened, there were two creatures that she described as hideous who grabbed her and drug her into a cavern and threw her into a cage with a bunch of other people. Now, according to the other people in the cage, they had all been kidnapped off elevators in various buildings in town. And the creatures seemed to be they would take various people out of the cages and into various tunnels, and they'd never be seen again. They never could find out what happened. And after several days, a group of normal appearing men with weapons appeared, apparently conducting a raid, and they took her back into one of the tunnels, and the next thing she knew, she was on a street. Now, when she got to her home, she had been missing for several days. The police had searched for her as best they could. She told her story, and the police went to the building where she had disappeared, and in the basement, the elevator cars only went as far as the basement, but in the bottom of the shaft, there was fresh concrete. Now, that story and several others came out of occupied France, which fits quite nicely with the Shaver mystery, if you've ever read any of that work, which was published in World War II, or during World War II, by Amazing Stories magazine. And a lot of people wrote in that they'd had similar experiences, even though the stories in Amazing Stories were supposed to be fiction. So that kind of goes along with a number of stories that purport that we occupy this planet with another race. Certainly that can be true. Now, sometimes kind deeds get repaid in the most peculiar ways. This story comes from 1952. A Navy pilot by the name of Riordan, or Reardon, depending on how you want to pronounce it, was coming home from the Naval Air Base where he was stationed when he saw cars on the highway swerving around something. And when he approached, he saw they were swerving to go around a man laying in the middle of the road. Apparently, they thought he was drunk and passed out, because they were cussing at him out the window. Well, he pulled off the road and, and approached the figure and discovered he had a big gash in his head, and apparently was unconscious. So he gave him first aid and sent for an ambulance. And when the ambulance took the guy away, he went home and forgot the whole thing. Several months later, he was flying over the same area, but there was a blinding snowstorm. And the air intakes on three of the plane's engines became clogged with snow. And when that happens, you get a flame out. The plane crashed in the woods close to the airbase. Well, his crash was spotted. He fell off radar, and they knew he was getting close to approach. And when the ambulance arrived, they found that the pilot was hanging by his legs from a jagged piece of steel. And the sharp edges on that jagged piece of steel had already cut through his legs down to the bone. The only reason they didn't slice his legs off was a man standing directly under the pilot, holding him up, so his body weight wouldn't result in his legs being cut off. And the man said he'd been standing there holding that pilot for over an hour. Well, when they the rescuers got the pilot down and stopped the bleeding, he regained consciousness for a short time and recognized the man that had held him up for all that time until rescue could arrive was the same man he had rescued from the middle of the road. You know, a lot of strange stories come out of the Midwest, Arkansas, Missouri, Oklahoma. Well, this particular story, this young lady heard from her grandparents. And they lived in the northern part of Missouri in the late 1800s. Now, at that point in time, there was a steady flow of people still going west by wagon train. And one day, and their farm was kind of out of the way, a single wagon came down the dirt road that ran in front of her grandparents' farm. And it was a man, a woman, and two children. And the man driving the team of horses stopped, and in those days, folks were glad to see company. Even if they didn't know them, they were glad to see them. And the man told the young lady's grandfather, "We're lost. We're with a wagon train, but we stopped because of the children, and the other wagons kept going, and somehow we must have taken a wrong turn." Well, they were asked to stay for a while, but they were in a hurry to catch up with the wagon train, so they were given instructions on how to get back to the main road. So then, the family in the wagon left. Well, the grandfather turned to his wife and said, "You are very talkative for once." And his wife said, "Well, I didn't know you spoke German." And the grandfather said, "German? I don't speak any foreign languages. What in the world are you talking about, woman?" And the grandmother said, "I don't know for sure what language it was, but it sounded like German to me. That's why I wouldn't say anything, because I couldn't understand what y'all were talking about." So somehow, the grandfather was able to speak a language he didn't know. But stranger things have happened. There was there have been a number of stories that I've heard about phantom locomotives. Now you have to remember that sometimes the gift of tongue is, I assume it is. Now, this took place during World War I. And this family was living up near the Canadian border. And there was a mother-in-law, her younger son, and her married son and the daughter-in-law. The mother-in-law's oldest son was in the British Army, but he'd written that he was leaving Liverpool for the U.S. I'd hear from him when he got here. And he was due any day, and so they kept watching the daily arrival of the train. And on this particular night, there was trouble on the railroad, and there'd be no train. But about 10 o'clock that night, the lights of the southbound passenger train could be seen in the distance. Now, the tracks were no more than a quarter of a mile from the house, and the trains were always visible to them. But they were a little surprised to see this one, because they had been told very specifically there would be no trains the remainder of that night. Well, as they watched the lights coming, strange thing happened. The locomotive slowed and finally came to a full stop. Headlights were blazing and the lights on all the coaches were burning bright. And the shades on the windows were only halfway down, so they could see in and the seats could be seen very clearly. And there wasn't a single solitary soul sitting on any of the seats. Not a passenger, not a conductor, not a trainman, anywhere. Well, it was very quiet. they stepped out of the house, of course, because this was without precedence. And it was dead silence. And as they watched, the headlights blink several times as if conveying a message. For over 10 minutes, that train sat there. Before it moved off down the track. Well, the unmarried brother ran down to the post office the next morning and came back to say the train never came in at all. It'd be noon before the train got there because it hadn't left Winnipeg until 10 o'clock the night before. But at 10 o'clock, the two women had seen the train sitting no more than a quarter of a mile from their house. The oldest son that they were waiting on with great anticipation never did arrive. Never seen again. Could the disappearance of that young man and the mystery train have had some kind of connection? Perhaps. You know, sometimes the human mind can play tricks, and sometimes those tricks are real. Case in point, dealt with a 17-year-old girl named Susie Smith. And she was the organist at Webster Hall in Lawrence, Massachusetts. She was attractive. Her father was a prominent man, Dr. Greenleaf Smith. And she had a large circle of friends. Well, she went on a trip to visit her sister who lived in Denmark, Maine. And while she was on a trip, she became very ill. And one morning she awoke from a deep sleep and said, "I've attended my own funeral." And she proceeded to describe that funeral, gave the names of the hymns she'd heard, and her father, mother, brother, and sister listened in total bafflement. She was perfectly rational the rest of the day. And then about 6 o'clock that evening, she had violent spasms. She became very pale. And she died. Well, after a few minutes, as they sat a little stunned by her death, the dead girl spoke. It was a deep, gruff voice, and it said, "Rub both of her arms as hard as you can." So they rubbed and they massaged and they rubbed, and then a different voice said, "Raise her up." Dr. Smith raised the body of his daughter to a sitting position, sitting behind her to support her. And the girl began to breathe. Then a different voice came from the girl. "If I could move her legs around so I could sit her up on the footboard, she'd be all right." And the doctor tried to manhandle the limp body of his daughter when suddenly he and the body of the girl both rose into the air and were placed on the footboard by some unseen force. And then another voice could be heard from the young woman's lips. And the doctor started to ask, shouldn't he lay his daughter's body down, when an unseen force picked him up and set him on his feet and her in the original position on the bed. But she appeared as dead as she had before. After several minutes, a fifth voice started a conversation from the dead girl's body that lasted over 3 hours. This fifth voice admitted that the body had been controlled by spirits. And after 3 hours of conversation, the girl slipped into a trance-like sleep. The next morning, the supposedly dead girl opened her eyes, and a sixth voice asked, "Who am I?" And the father answered, "You're Susie Smith." And the voice responded, "No, I ain't. She died last night." Now, that voice for the rest of the day continued to maintain that the girl was dead, and it couldn't figure out what it was doing there. And there were all kinds of spasms and changes and different personalities. And by noon the next day, the body was dead one more time. Well, convinced that his daughter was finally dead once and for all, Dr. Smith had the body prepared for burial and taken to a room on the lower floor of the house. That used to be the custom. Bodies would lay out in the home and people would sit with it. Now, that custom came from the old tradition that sometimes evil spirits would possess a body on the first night of death, and that's why that custom came into being. Well, they sat there discussing what to do with the body, take it home or bury her in Maine. And the apparition said she wanted to be buried on the schoolhouse hill right there in Denmark, Maine. And that's where she was buried. You know, sometimes possession can be, brought about, as it were. There was a story told by a woman about her niece. And she said at age 2, the niece was a very unusual child. She seemed much more intelligent and much older than her years would warrant. But she was a happy child. until her parents moved to a new home. Well, this was in Terre Haute, Indiana. They found a huge old house. It was a bargain. Big bedrooms. Because the family was growing. The young niece was the fifth child. And the mother was pregnant with the sixth. On the day they moved in, they found a smoldering teddy bear in the attic. Nobody could figure out how the bear got there or how it caught on fire. But once they were settled in the house, this young niece began to have severe nightmares and visions, and, of course, need to get you that video on the Watsaka Wonder. And the mass burial ground in Indiana. Well, now, I had a video once of a young lady who was so unusual, she was known as Wonder Woman. Is that close? I liked her outfit. Very impressed. I saw one this morning that was very impressive. I go to the gym just to watch the view. Anyway, in the early hours of the morning, quite often, that little girl come running into her parents' room, clutching her doll, going, "Mommy, he pushed me out of bed again. He won't let me sleep, and he's trying to take my doll." He killed a bunch of orphans and just threw them in the pit. Well, I'd like to see that video. And at other times of the day, she'd run into the kitchen where her mother usually was and complained that he had pulled her hair and pinched her. But while she could never communicate who he was, it was clear it was always the same individual, and it was a male. And the only time they put cyanide in their milk, I prefer chocolate syrup. Once they said that the visitor that was giving her all the trouble was big and old like Pappy, which was her name for her great-grandfather. And sometimes these events were so traumatic, the young girl was almost hysterical. And another time, she would refuse to discuss the visits of this entity. Well, the parents, kind of put it up to her imagination being overstimulated. And they thought perhaps she needed a playmate. She needed to be more socialized, I guess you could say. But that didn't seem to do much about the nighttime terrors she was experiencing. And then one afternoon, the unseen visitor nearly killed the young girl. She was sitting in a sitter in the dining room when suddenly she began to scream. And the mother ran in and found her entire body on fire. She had burns over 75% of her body, requiring months of hospitalization and many skin grafts. Well, they searched and they couldn't find any reason for her to catch on fire. But while she hovered between life and death in the hospital, the ant found what may be the reason for the occurrence. She was working as a nurse's aide at the hospital and in a small coffee shop. Quite often you'd be set at a table with a stranger. And one day she was seated with an elderly nurse's aide she hadn't met before, and they were discussing patients and complaining about the nasty ones, and the old nurse's aide began to talk about a neighbor of hers, old Mr. Clayton. He hated everything but kids most of all. In fact, he swore that if any child ever moved into his house, the parents would be sorry. Well, let's see. Boom, boom, boom. Let's see. A lot of that going around this time of year. Anyway, now he was a crazy man. He died the year before of a heart attack. He burned to death in his bed. And it turns out Mr. Clayton lived in the house that the young girl's parents moved into. There are stranger stories, much stranger. Now this hour is brought to you by The Garden, 511 Western, the place at Union Plaza. Outstanding restaurant. They got everything from sushi to hamburgers, and I particularly like their hamburgers, and I'm a hamburger aficionado. You know, there are a number of highways in the Southwest that are known there was Route 666, which was known as the Devil's Highway, and there's also a Ghost Highway. And this trucker, and I have a lot of listeners here, truckers, and quite often they submit very interesting stories. And this one trucker worked for a Phoenix-based company, and he was pulling a load of minivans from Louisiana to Phoenix in an 11-ton Chevy with a 48-foot trailer. And the truck was really acting up. He didn't think he was going to make it to Phoenix. So when he got to the El Paso, he went to the petrol truck stop. He was tired and he had a headache and really in some distress. Now he had some coffee and talked to some fellow truckers, and frankly he should have stopped for the night because petrol's got rooms. And he left the truck stop and drove to exit 3. He took Highway 13, which should have told him something. He said there was no traffic at all, and the road was like just a clear white ribbon. The pavement was smooth, and the truck was running smoothly like it was brand new. None of the previous problems rose their ugly head. There was no scenery, there was no road markers. But he did pass three old Indian cemeteries. Now, he knew he had at least a 7-hour trip ahead of him. So, he was hoping none of those problems he had experienced before would pop up. He was feeling better physically, and it never really crossed his mind that there were no exits for truck stops or anything else. Now, there was a legend he had heard among truckers that if a trucker going from El Paso to Phoenix was really in trouble, he'd find himself on Highway 13 and have a safe journey all the way home. This was known as the Ghost Highway. One trucker had been violently ill when he got to El Paso, but he'd been determined to get home to Phoenix, so instead of stopping, he drove from El Paso to Phoenix along Highway 13, even though he had suffered a massive coronary. He drove safely 412 miles before collapsing. Now, though I'm in El Paso, I've never been on Highway 13, but then I don't drive a truck. He said he looked out the window to the left, and sitting quietly on top of a flat rock was a huge, pure white wolf. Made no effort to move, just sat and watched him. He said he barely passed the wolf when he saw his first road sign. Said Arizona state line, 9 miles. And that baffled him because he'd only been on the road for about 2 hours. And then he came to the only exit he'd seen off Highway 13. And the sign said Phoenix, 18 miles. He drove into the company yard about 2.5 hours after leaving El Paso. A 7-hour trip in 2.5 hours. By the time he got to his destination, the truck was really acting up again. In fact, the mechanic couldn't understand how he'd actually made it all the way there. But that's the benefit of being on Highway 13. Now, I know where Exit 3 is, but I'm not familiar with a Highway 13. There's another story. Came out of Chicago. The young man in question was a stock boy at a shoe store. And one of the managers was very interested in parapsychology and metaphysics. A lot of people called it witchcraft. And part of this young man's daily routine would be teasing the manager about her belief in the supernatural. And then after, he would always declare he had no superstitions about anything, so he used to dare her to try to do something to him to prove that the supernatural existed. Now, she tried to explain the difference between witchcraft and parapsychology, but wasn't doing any good. And one day he just flat out dared her to do something to prove her witch's abilities. And finally she agreed, and she took a pencil and a piece of paper, and she wrote something on it. And she put it in an envelope and sealed it and put it in her desk drawer. And she said, "Let's see if anything happens." Well, he was just tickled pink. He was going to prove to her there was nothing to any of this bull. And he walked away feeling mighty proud of himself. Well, several weeks passed, and the young man was a little less confrontational about the topic of parapsychology. Sometimes he'd arrive at work at various times with either a bandage on his hand or some other part of his anatomy, and she'd see him staring at her in a very confused manner, but he never would say anything. And then one bitterly cold day, he was working in the stock room when he was stung by a bee. Now, he stormed into her office and said, "I don't know what you wrote down, but my hands have been hurting me ever since. Whatever it is, will you please stop it?" Well, she opened a drawer and handed him the sealed envelope. And he opened it and looked at it and walked away. And what she had written on that piece of paper was, "Whenever you have an evil or wrong thought, it will be reflected with an injury to your hands, and you are in complete control over this situation." Well, frankly, I think the manager was every bit as surprised as the young man was. You know, there's a lot of very odd superstitions. And Puerto Rico is a country of very superstitious people. I spent a little bit of time there. And there was a story came out of a small farming community called Las Carolinas. And this young man, I think he was 18 or 19 at the time I was told the story, because the people I was doing business with knew I was interested in the paranormal, and in the evenings, if you didn't want to carouse and drink and chase women, there wasn't a whole lot to do. So they'd tell stories. And this young man was a big fan of satanic rock music. He had satanic posters all over his walls. But even though he was a big fan of satanic music, he was Catholic, and he never missed a single night of praying to God and the Virgin Mary. And the last thing he remembered seeing each night as he fell asleep was the corner of his room. And for about 2 or 3 weeks, every night he dreamed of that corner over and over and over. And one day a strange figure appeared in his dreams, a man dressed all in black. And as the nights progressed, the dreams continued, but in each dream, the man would become more violent. And he would approach the bed, and he'd grab an arm or a leg and slam them hard against the bed. Now, the young man, of course, believed it was only a dream, but What night he woke up immediately after the dream, it was 4 a.m. But he was going to get up for the day, get an early start. And suddenly there was that figure dressed in black. And he grabbed a leg and slammed it against the bed as hard as he could. And the young man panicked. I mean, he knew he wasn't asleep. He knew this was real. But as soon as he inflicted that pain, he disappeared. The next morning, he told his father about what was going on. And since there's an answer to everything in the Catholic Church, his father gave him a small statue of the Virgin Mary, which he put on the windowsill right by the bed. The next night, he had that same dream, but this time the strange figure decided to put an end to his nightly visits. He was going to take his soul. Well, the young man tried to open his eyes, but he felt two hands holding the eyelids down. And somehow he knew it was the Virgin Mary, blocking his view of what was happening. He heard metallic sounds above him like swords clanging. Well, he believed that that figure was Satan coming to claim him because he listened to satanic music. But the Virgin Mary showed up, complete with her own sword, to save him. Now, figures dressed in black are nothing new. We found a lot of those stories in regard to alien abductions and the old hag syndrome and shadow people all dressed in black. It's interesting that so many of these entities react to Catholic rituals and Catholic symbols. It really makes you wonder, is it because they're all Catholic or because religious symbols somehow are end-all be-all to dealing with creatures? There was a woman who told a story about her sister seeing a shadow of a woman on a dining room wall. And her son made the comment that the shadow resembled her. And that night, when she saw it again, she realized her son was right. And then she began to dream that after she went to bed that she was trapped inside the wall at the very spot where that shadow was at. It was like some powerful force was holding her there and she couldn't move. The next morning, she examined that shadow again. And then she decided to check the rest of the wall. And there was a large mirror that hung to the left of the shadow. And she took that mirror down and there was another shadow. The shadow of a devil. She could very clearly see the horns. And this devil head looked like a cross between a rabbit and a donkey. I guess you'd call that a ronkey. The There was one eye in the head of that devil, and it seemed alive. A week after this discovery, her 18-year-old son told her that he had been molested by his stepfather. A night or two later, the woman called her sister to come over to look at the shadows. And the sister, being a good Catholic, suggested she splash holy water on the wall. Of course, that's a cure for everything. And then she soaked some paper towels in the holy water and rubbed them back and forth across the shadows. Well, the wallpaper dried and the shadows were still there. Three times the woman attempted to wash away the shadows with holy water, but they're still there. But after the last washing, there are now two more sets of eyes on the devil head. One resembling human eyes and the other one animal eyes. All quite evil looking in the opinion of the person telling the story. And in another room, in the bedroom of the stepfather, an imprint of the stepfather in an obscene pose has appeared on the ceiling. It's interesting when things like this happen. It's a mystery to which we can never have an answer. You know, there have been a number of stories told by people who apparently have stepped back in time. There was two individuals who spent a holiday back in, I think it was 1963 or 4, in Bruges, Belgium. And they toured the town in a horse-drawn cab. And they stopped at several places of interest along the way, and one of those places was the old people's almshouses. Now, almshouses were basically debtor's prison, more or less. It's where elderly people went who couldn't afford to support themselves. And they found themselves in a square surrounded on three sides by cottages. And elderly people were sitting about talking and making lace at little tables that were set up. And one lady invited one of the two into her cottage and offered her, you know, a delicacy. The other one bought a lace-edge handkerchief. Now, they were in that town for about a week, and before they departed, they decided to have another horse-drawn cab tour. And they asked the driver to take them to that same almshouse. Well, the scene was quite different than the first time. There were no people. And on the previous, on that first visit, the week before, there was a plot of untilled ground right in the center of the the area that held all the cottages. This time, what had been the untilled ground was now covered with fully grown flowers and vegetables. Now, during that first visit, they'd gone by the local chapel, which was on about halfway down the block on the left-hand side. That first time was very memorial. They remembered everything. It was, and they'd looked forward to seeing it just once more before they left. Well, this time, there were no lace makers, and the chapel wasn't there. Eventually, the chapel was found at the end of the block, and when they questioned the attendant, he said, yeah, it used to be halfway down that block, but it's been moved. And they were mystified. They couldn't understand why the first time there had been so many people present and all the cottages were open and people couldn't do enough for them, and how that open field at the center had been uncultivated a week before and now it had all these plants and vegetables. And how did the chapel get moved and rebuilt in just a few days? The only proof they had was that handkerchief that one of the couple had bought. Because that was as real could be. Is it possible to step back through time? There's a story of two school teachers who went to Paris. And they wanted to go to the cottage where Marie Antoinette used to sit and paint. That story I've told a couple of times on the show. Suffice it to say, they saw the area as it was slightly before the French Revolution. They were actually interacting with individuals who were historical characters. You know, there are numerous stories . This one comes out of San Diego, I think it was. There was a woman who lived in an apartment. And she was ironing. Now, this was 1951, I think. She's listening to the radio, playing popular music. And suddenly the music ended in mid-note. She couldn't figure out what the problem was. There was no sound at all from the radio, not even static. And she wondered if the station was having trouble, maybe the power had gone off, but the iron was still working. And then she noticed the room began to go dark. She sat the iron in a safe place and turned it off, and she couldn't figure out what was happening. Was she about to faint? I mean, what was going on? Was there a storm coming? It still looked... The sky was blue and it was a lot of cloud in the sky. But the room turned a dark gray. And she backed away from the ironing board And in the center of the room, there appeared a large rock. And she couldn't take her eyes off that rock. And then suddenly the room was filled with a bluish glow coming from just above the rock. And suddenly there stood a woman. She was absolutely the most beautiful woman she'd ever seen. She was wearing a graceful white and blue dress. And the witness was overcome with a feeling of unbelievable peace. And she said, "Ave Maria." And the woman looked down at her and smiled and responded, "Dominus vobiscum." And the witness responded, "Et cum spiritu tuo." And with that, the woman was gone. The room was sunny again. The radio was playing the same song. For several days, the witness mulled over the event in silence and didn't want to mention it to anybody for fear they'd think she was crazy. And she couldn't figure out why she knew how to speak Latin in this vision. Now, she had a working knowledge from her going to Catholic school, but it's rarely something that you indulge in. So she went to a psychiatrist she worked for and said, "Am I crazy?" And he said, "Probably not." Do people have visions of the Virgin Mary? Well, there have been stories of her appearing on everything from towers in Eastern Europe to hunks of bread in people's apartments. And yet, if you know anything at all about the true history of the church, there's very little reason that the Virgin Mary would have any impact on anything. Of course, I've often said that there is an entity that takes advantage of our beliefs. And those that are the easiest to take advantage of are those who are fanatically religious. But we'll talk about that another time. You know, Yoli talks about guardian angels. And there are a number of others who claim that they can see, hear, and talk to angels whenever they want to. And many of them say that we communicate with our guardian angel, we just don't pay any attention to them. Angels are subtle. Sometimes they put inspirational ideas in your head. Sometimes they won't answer our questions. And, you know, with Yoli, sometimes the angel won't answer questions. And many of those who are who study the guardian angel phenomena say that we're all students put here to learn things. And dealing with tough situations is supposed to help us grow. And growth is sometimes painful. But if your guardian angel intervenes, then the learning process can be a little less painful. There's a young man by the name of Richard Bauman who claims that a guardian angel saved his life when he was 13 years old. He was crossing a four-lane highway full of fast-moving trucks and cars in South El Monte, California. And if you've ever been down there, it is definitely a hustle and bustle place. He wheeled his bicycle into the crosswalk and was getting ready to go as soon as the light turned green. And it changed and got ready to pedal. And he got ready to push off and ride quickly across the street when suddenly the right foot, which was on the pedal, ready to push, didn't slip off the pedal. It was knocked off the pedal. It was pushed off. He lunged forward, but the bicycle didn't move. And he glanced to his left, and there was a car coming fast. And the woman driving the car looked absolutely shocked, because had he pushed off into that crosswalk, she would have hit him. She hadn't seen either the red light or him until it was too late to stop. Now, the young man said, considering the position of the pedal and his momentum, it was impossible for his foot to have slipped off the pedal. It had to have been pulled off or pushed off. But he credits his guardian angel. There was a young lady. She was a school librarian. This was about 30-some-odd years ago. She hadn't told many people about what happened. You know, she, as usual, she didn't want to be thought to be crazy. And one afternoon, as she worked, she heard a siren. So she raised one of the windows in the building and looked out, and in the street below, an ambulance had stopped, and two paramedics were working over a small figure lying on the ground behind a school bus. The bus had backed into a second grader. And suddenly, the clerk who was with her made a gasp and said, "I just heard him say he's dead." And at that moment, the librarian said, all sound ceased. It was as if she was in another dimension. And she looked around the room in which she was in and was awestruck. The room was filled with what she called ghost-like figures, clothed in gowns of soft white light. And one or two of these figures stood behind each of the 20 children who were browsing in the library. and she knew there were guardian angels. Two of the third grade boys, she said, approached her with a question, and while she could see their mouths move, she couldn't hear a word they were saying. And though she wanted to remain in this strange state, she knew that she needed to respond to these two students. So she forced herself to concentrate, and with a very discernible jolt, things were back to normal. Well, it turns out the young man hadn't died. He had both his legs broken, and it was several months, but he was back in school. But she firmly believed in guardian angels, just as Yoli does, and this, just as so many of you call in for readings do. Now, if any of you have stories of your own, you want to get involved in the conversation, you pick up that phone. Locally is 915-219-4210. Toll free from any place in the continental United States, 866-229-2155 or 347-857-2680. Or you can call through Skype. Any of those numbers will get you back on the show. There's another story that comes out of Biggsville. It happened in World War II. And they were training B-29 crews. And there hadn't been any major problems. And during the first half of the training, they had to accomplish a series of high-altitude progressive stalls, which you did by reducing power while climbing until the plane becomes sluggish and begins to shudder. And at that point, the pilot increases the power and they recover from the stall and away you go. Now, these planes have been modified. The main gun turrets and the fire control system have been removed. And the tail gunner and the radar was still in place. Now, this was what was called combat position because the reduced weight gave the aircraft a faster cruising speed and a slower landing speed. And it could go to higher altitudes. Now, there's one particular crew were assigned a Czech pilot who was a fighter pilot on R&R from England. And unfortunately, he hadn't flown anything bigger than a P-47 or a P-51, which were the state-of-the-art fighter planes in that period in World War II. And he had another little problem that had slipped past the instructors. He had a drinking problem, and he had smuggled a bottle on board. Well, the individual telling the story was, he was in the aft pressurized section where he could watch and report landing gear and flap problems. And if there was a problem, he was still alert to crew. So they took off, and they were flying about 35,000 feet. And they were going between 380 and 400 miles per hour. And they started the first of the the practice stalls. And every time they did one of the stalls, the drunken Czech pilot would yell, "That was no blankety-blank stall." And finally, he yelled, "I'll show you what a stall is," and he shut everything down. The nose went down and the tail went up, and it was going down like a rock. Well, they were losing altitude fast, and they were heading for the ground faster. Now, there was no way anybody could have done anything. They were going to crash. There was absolutely no way that they could have survived that. And they were getting so close to the ground that there was no way they could avoid crashing. The safety observer hit the intercom switch and said, "Inch the flaps up." And then he jumped into his seat and buckled himself in. When he lifted his head and he looked, all he saw was a blur. He looked out the rear bubble and he saw a cloud of dust that the airplane had picked up off the desert floor. Now, all the way back to Fort Biggs Field, the Czech pilot, who was a lieutenant colonel, was beside himself. He didn't want to. He begged him not to report him, but they did, and he got reduced to second lieutenant. And some of the things that were done on that plane should not have had the effect of getting them back in the air, but it did. The plane was never flown again. The wings were warped. The wing tips were about a foot higher than they should have been. Though no one saw it happen, they're sure that that plane bounced off the desert floor. But what should have been a tremendous crash and the death of the entire crew was, no one can explain it. Back in 1941, tuberculosis was a devastating illness. A lot of people were sent to the Midwest and to the Southwest because of the weather, and a lot of them, there were a lot of sanatoriums. And this one individual was a tuberculosis patient in one of the sanatoriums. And he had earphones over his head, and he was listening to a program of Cole Porter music. It was winter, early evening. Just getting dark. As he laid there listening to the music and looking through the window, he watched a procession of people dressed in white walk past. They moved slowly, four walking in a single file, and two others who supported a third person. Now, it was getting dark, and the individual who was, you know how you get one of those states when you're listening to music and you kind of zone out? Well, that's what happened to this tuberculosis patient, because the room in which he was lying was actually on the second floor and there was no balcony. And when he realized that, it blew his mind. He sat up and he grabbed the bell and he rang it and rang it and rang it, and of course no one responded. And after a while he became calm and decided he must have fallen asleep. And the nurse finally showed up and gave him hell for all the ruckus. But seeing how upset he was, gave him a sedative. And he asked why it took her so long to respond. And she said, well, all the nurses were helping care for the little Mexican girl in one of the other rooms. She just died. And that's when he realized who the person being supported by the two individuals had been. It had been that little Mexican girl. He was permitted to witness her heavenly escort on her journey home. Or was he just dreaming? You know, sometimes when medical science has given up, the human mind is able to heal itself. There was a woman told a story about her father who was taken to the emergency room, and he would drift in and out of sleep. No doubt he was in serious condition, but when he was awake, he was lucid. But when he was awake, he would ask them the strangest questions. He kept wanting to know who the man was in the corner. And they assured him that there was nobody there. And he kept asking about this flight of steps he could see on one side of the room. But he was half blind to begin with, and there were curtains around his bed, so there were no steps he could actually see. But he kept talking about them. And all through the night, he would wake up and ask a question and then go back to sleep. At one point, he woke up and asked them to turn out the bright lights over his head. They were hurting his eyes. So they turned out the overhead lights, and he went back to sleep. Shortly, he woke up again and said, I thought I told you to turn out those bright lights. They're hurting my eyes. There were no lights burning. Now, her father had always been very fond of her husband, who was himself fighting cancer at the time. And when finally everyone realized that the father was dying and were resigned to it, he called the girl over and he said, your husband doesn't have cancer anymore. It's my gift to you. And his daughter responded, well, yeah, it's in remission, but he still has it. said, no, you take him to three of the best cancer doctors, and they'll tell you he doesn't have cancer. Well, Father died shortly after that. And the daughter didn't think anything more about what she considered her father's delusion. One afternoon, her husband picked her up from work, and he had a very puzzled look on his face. And she asked him what the problem was, and he said he'd just come from the doctor who said he didn't have to come back anymore. He was fine. He no longer had cancer. But we seem to have another hacking. She remembered her great-grandmother had told her that when the angel of death takes a soul, he sometimes gives a life back in return. And that, she believes, is what happened when her father died. The angel of death gave her back her husband. There was a woman not seeing anything. Well, opening your eyes will help. You want to take... Well, there's no gooses here, so bringing a gander wouldn't help. Of course, you might consider it foul. It was in October 1960 that a woman decided to take a walk along the river. I'm sure she had a number of things on her mind. She had just been told she had an incurable heart condition. Exercise, anything left her weak and breathless. But in the middle of her quiet breakfast that morning, she put down her cup of coffee, put on an old coat, and walked down to the riverbank. And as she went on her errand, she looked back and saw the smoke rising from her neighbor's chimney. She was a little disturbed about this certain urge she had, but it made her feel a little better to know that there was someone not too far away. She returned her vision back to the path along which she was walking, and there, standing directly in front of her, stood a gypsy. And there used to be a lot of gypsies in this country. There would be, I know where I grew up, there were gypsy caravans quite often who came by. But this gypsy stood silently in the middle of the path all by herself. And she held out her hands to the woman and with her palms up. And the gypsy said, don't be alarmed. I had to come. You have to know the truth. Will you let me tell your fortune? Well, like most people, she didn't believe in such things. And she was a little frightened. I mean, where did the gypsy come from? What was she doing here? Or was she losing it? And she looked back toward her house, and there stood her husband. And she waved, and he waved back, and that gave her a little bit more confidence. So she turned back to the gypsy and said, "I don't want my fortune told. I'm busy and in a hurry." And the gypsy said again, "I had to come to you. Don't you understand? You must know the truth. Cross my hand, cross my palm with silver so I can tell your fortune." And she realized in her pocket was a piece of silver. Didn't know where it came from, but it was in her pocket. So she pulled it out and crossed the gypsy's palm. And the gypsy said, "Someone whom you think is a friend has put a curse on you. It's ruining your health, your heart. You must break the spell. Tomorrow at exactly noon, lock your door and sit down and drink a large glass of water. In one large breath, there'll be an interruption, but don't stop. Finish the water and keep your eyes closed. And do this again on the second day. And on the third day, the person that put the curse on you is going to come to borrow something. But finish the water. Drink it down and then answer the door and refuse whatever she asks. Turn her away and the spell will be broken." And the gypsy turned away without a word and disappeared. And she returned home. Her husband was waiting for her and wanted to know why she was out in the cold. And wanted to know who the friend was. And she told her husband everything, and of course he laughed. And the next day she sat down to drink that glass of water, and halfway through the phone rang, and she ignored the ringing phone. The same on the second day. And on the third day, as she sat there drinking her water, someone ran up and began to pound on her door. And she finished the water, went to the door, and it was her neighbor, asking to borrow some cord to wrap a package. And she said, "I have no cord and I'm busy." And the next day she went to her doctor for a regular checkup. And he was so amazed at what he found, he called in two other doctors who agreed her incurable heart condition had vanished. Do curses work? Woman and her daughter one Christmas were shopping. And they came upon a box of two olive green candles in a gift shop. And tucked in the box was a slip of paper saying that these were bayberry candles, and if one burned them between Christmas and New Year's Eve and made a wish, the wish would come true. So Christmas Eve, the entire family gathered to celebrate. And as they distributed all the presents, the last one to be opened were the little bayberry candles. So the mother couldn't wait to light them and make the wish. I mean, even though we all profess not to believe in such superstitious goings on, there's no question that deep down there is some level of belief. Well, the mother lit them and sat before the two candles, thinking how nice it would be if her wish did come true. She had a large family. She had a son in the Air Force and another son worked in a far-off city. And the youngest daughter still lived at home. But the mother had been harboring a wish to spend at least a week or two alone, just herself, somewhere away from family responsibilities. And that was her wish, as she stared deeply into the flickering candle flames. Then suddenly she saw a picture in the flames. She saw her youngest daughter, complete bridal attire. And she didn't even have a steady boyfriend. Next, she saw her oldest daughter holding a tiny baby that she wasn't expecting. And finally, she saw herself walking with the aid of crutches. Well, the oldest daughter came upon her mother at that moment and noticed her face was white as a sheet. And she asked her what the problem was, and the mother told her daughter what she'd seen. But the wish did come true. The next summer, the mother traveled alone for a vacation. And in a nearby town, she attended an art show, and looking at the paintings rather than where she was going, she fell and broke her ankle. So she had to use crutches. And shortly after that, the youngest daughter met a man, and they were married in December of 1968. And the oldest daughter and her husband adopted a 4-day-old son. Each vision came to pass. You know, when you have a relative who is a psychic, sometimes you can't resist putting them to the test. And this one young lady, her mother was a psychic, and she was gifted in psychometry, which is when you hold something in your hand and you know the history of the item you're holding. And at dinner parties, the mother would quite often be called upon to perform, and she would amaze and astound their friends by taking various items and giving detailed descriptions of where it came from and events associated with it and so on and so forth. Now, the mother died in April of 1936. And several years before her death, her daughter decided to test her mother. She had a button from the uniform of a soldier who had been in some of the bloodiest action in World War I. Now, the button had been put up for years, and the mother surely had forgotten about it. So she wrapped the button in several handkerchiefs so the mother would not know if it was a ring or any of a dozen other small items. And the moment the woman took it into her hands, she described the scene of a battle that made everyone's hair stand on end. Men dying, guns roaring, planes diving, and all the confusion and terror of war. In fact, the mother was so horrified she threw the little bundle across the room. But that proved to her daughter that her mother's gift was real. Now, a lot of people have asked me about Ouija boards. And a lot of people look at Ouija boards as a toy. In fact, Milton Bradley, or Parker Brothers, I don't remember which, actually markets it as a toy. But one day, it proved itself to be far more than a toy. The friend of the owner was asking some questions of Ouija, and he'd been offered a choice of positions and wondering which one he should accept. So they decided to ask the Ouija board. Now, sometimes the Ouija board is active and sometimes it's not. But on this particular afternoon, it was extremely active. But any time they ask about the young man or his job, they got the same answer: dead or will die. Now, the young man was in the medical field, and he had a patient who was dying, and of course they thought that it concerned this patient. But no matter how they phrased the question, they always got the answers dead or will die. Well, it was freaking out the young man who wanted to know which job to accept. So they decided to stop. Now, this was in July of 55, I think it was. A week later, they had dinner close to the airport and watched the planes coming and going. And his friend made the comment, "There's nothing I'd rather do than spend the rest of my life flying." Well, he asked his friend, had he decided which job to take? And he said, "No, somehow it doesn't seem important now." And he didn't know why it didn't seem important, but it just did. And then he made the strange comment that it'd be wonderful flying around in those beautiful clouds. The next Sunday, the friend was invited to go flying with a very experienced pilot in a small plane. They'd been flying about a half hour when the plane was caught in a downdraft and crashed. Both men were killed. The Ouija board was right when it predicted dead or will die to all of his questions. You know, sometimes you get the strangest information from the strangest sources. This one young lady, her mother detested the very idea of owning a pet, especially a cat. Some people just don't like cats. And her excuse was cats made messes, but she wasn't the best housekeeper. And finally one day she confessed to her daughter why she wouldn't ever consider owning a cat. Her mother was from Greece, a little village of Petaliti. And in the spring of 1943, a gypsy knocked on the door of her mother's home. And the gypsy told the young lady who was telling the story's grandmother, "Do you recall the branch of oleander someone placed on your doorstep on May 1st? And the grandmother replied, "Yes, but it was only a joke." And the gypsy said, "You're wrong, it was witchcraft." And the gypsy asked the woman to let her come into the house to remove the hex from the grandmother and the family. But the grandmother said she didn't believe in witchcraft and she was a widow with four children to raise and didn't have time for foolishness. And the gypsy said, "Yes, I know. Your husband died, and his death was followed by your newborn son's cribbed death. And now your oldest son is suffering from intense pain in his right arm that the doctors can't diagnose." And once again, she asked to be allowed to remove the hex from the family. So the grandmother let the gypsy into the kitchen, and there stood the four children. The gypsy asked for a glass of water and she placed a cloth over it and chanted in the language of the gypsies. After a few moments, she removed the cloth from the glass and the water had turned to seawater. It was cloudy with sand accumulating in the bottom of the glass. So she pulled a fish hook out of the glass, and attached to the hook were bits of cloth and buttons, a tiny fish and a few strands of hair. And the gypsy said these were personal items that the original caster of the spell had stolen from the family. The cat was in the kitchen at that particular moment. And the gypsy poured the water from the glass over the cat. Kind of, I'm sure, pissed off the cat. And next, the gypsy asked the grandmother for a round loaf of bread. And she cut a circle out of the middle of the bread and placed the fish hook with all those personal items inside the bread. And the gypsy said at midnight she'd go out to the shore to toss that piece of bread into the sea. And the gypsy said that a hen would come out of the sea with her chicks and she would feed the rest of that bread to the chicks. And the gypsy also warned the grandmother never to buy herself a cat again because it would die. She had thrown the hex off the family and onto the cat. Well, shortly thereafter, and no one was sure how, the cat died. And the moment the cat died, the pain in the son's arm ended. Years later, when he was in his 30s, the sibling who had the pain in his arm tried owning a cat. But when they brought the cat into the house, it died. I know meepers or even seas water, they tend to freak. Certainly that can happen. During World War II, a woman's friend asked her to store a few things for her while she followed her husband to his new post. And she said, use whatever you'd like of my stuff while you're keeping it for me. Now, her father had come from India to America. And one of the things he had brought that was now the daughter's was a very old, beautifully handcrafted Ouija board. Now, the young lady who agreed to store her friend's possessions was married to a member of the Air Corps, who'd been injured at the 36th Street Air Force Base in Miami, Florida. And he was released to come home to convalesce. Women do not share. That is true. They do if their Lord and Master orders them to. Now, after a few days of him being home, they were looking for some entertainment, and what do they leave behind? Depends on how big the behind. Kim Kardashian leaves a lot behind. His wife remembered the Ouija board and thought perhaps they could get some answers to some questions. The husband's unit was expected to ship out either to Europe or Japan, so they wanted to know if the Ouija board, yes, Lord and Master. Ask Keith, the husband is the Lord and Master. He'll tell you. And when they asked the Ouija board, it said, white as snow. And they asked the Ouija board, what's white as snow? And they were told, sand. Well, they couldn't get it to give any more information. And they were somewhat annoyed. So they put the Ouija board back among the girls' things and forgot about it. Well, over the next year, she followed her husband. Keith is looking like, don't bring me into this. Wimp. And while in Alamogordo, New Mexico, the woman returned to their apartment and found a little pile of what appeared to be snow by the front steps. Well, they were in Alamogordo, and when she got to the apartment, she found by her front steps a bucket of what appeared to be snow. And it turned out to be chalk white sand from the White Sands National Monument, which was only about 20 miles from Alamogordo. Well, that was the sand that the Ouija board had predicted. You know, there's a number of other stories people have told about Ouija boards. There was a woman and her daughter used to sit down and ask questions of the Ouija board just for the fun of it. And one evening in May of 1965, she remembered it was about 9 in the evening. She made a pot of coffee and brought out some cookies, and they sat down to have some fun with the Ouija board. Now, as they moved the planchette, as it's called, around the board, it began to spell out, "You'll soon have money roll in from everywhere, and we'll start you with a blessed coin." And as the word coin was completed, a penny dropped to the board from the bottom of the planchette. Now, before they'd started to use the Ouija board, she'd polished it with a soft cloth and wiped the feet of the planchette to get rid of any dust and to make it move easily. If there'd been a penny stuck on the bottom, she'd have seen it. So the mother and daughter looked at each other in total amazement. And in the planchette went on to spell out, "Big oaks from little acorns grow." And it continued to move, and it spelled, "We love you. The coin would draw money to you like a magnet. Have faith in it." And the woman said, "Well, I've always liked lilacs. Why don't you, if you can fetch a coin, why not a lilac for me?" And the planchette spelled out, "What do you want more? You have little faith." And at that moment, a nickel dropped onto the floor beneath the kitchen window on the far side of the room. And then they began to smell a very strong floral scent from the table itself. And it kept getting stronger, and finally the mother asked what it was. And the Ouija board spelled out that the table had been magnetized, and then instead of the planchette moving, the board began to spin. Well, they decided to pack it in, but for that particular session. You know, tarot cards are another way of having your fortune told. And a woman went to have her the tarot cards read. And the fortune teller said, I see you moving from the house you're in. And the woman responded, impossible. We all love that house. It's got everything we want. We would never move. And the woman said, why? Why would we move? She was asked to shuffle the cards again and then find out. So she shuffled and one of the cards fell from the deck to the floor. It was a king. A dark card. And the psychic said, a dark man. And she asked, could you tell me a little bit more about him? And she said, you don't want to leave, but you will. And she asked, would I remarry then? And she said, I've told you all I can. Woman got up and paid for the reading. And the psychic said, almost as an afterthought, the house you'll move to will be further back from the road. And she wanted to ask more questions, but the psychic was not in a talkative mood at that particular moment. Well, about 3 months later, there was a knock at the door. And a tall, dark man. This is not a scary story. We're discussing psychics. And he asked, are you the owner of the property? And she said, well, why do you ask? Thinking he was a real estate agent. I'm with Keith. Leave me out of this too. I didn't know Keith was that way. And he said, I'm from the council and I'm afraid I have some bad news for you. Your house is one of those on our list for resumption. In other words, the city wanted the property for some municipal use. And he said, we'll give you market value. And she said, but I don't want to sell. Well, he said, I think you ought to accept our offer. And because once all the other homes have been taken, there'll be council trucks everywhere. They're making it into a substation. And all the other owners have agreed to sell. Well, she accepted the offer and she moved. And it wasn't until she got settled that she realized everything the psychic had said had come to pass. Her new house was further from the road than her old house, just as the psychic had said. Really? Exactly. You know, sometimes people laugh at the very idea of intuition, acting on a hunch. There was a young lady who was attending the Long Island College Hospital School of Nursing. And she went on a 30-day vacation. She took the subway to Grand Central Station, where she picked up her... Was that Yoli's reading? No, I was the one talking. I was talking about stories from around the world that had to do with predictions. She was going to northern New York State, where her family lived, and she was standing by the clock in the center of Grand Central Station when the gate slid back and the ticket conductor called, "All aboard." And even though she had gotten up there as fast as she could, there were three people in front of her. And the first person went through and headed for the train. And the second was handing his ticket to the conductor. And the young lady got a cold chill down her spine. She knew she had to get out of line. She didn't know why, but she knew she had to. So, mumbling, "Excuse me," she made, "Oh, thank you. I try. I've been practicing audio all day, so apparently it paid off." She almost ran back to the big clock, and people looked at her like she was crazy, as New Yorkers tend to do. And she felt an unbelievable relief. She just stood there. Now, her family expected her at 7:30 the next morning. And since she wasn't going to take that train, she'd have to call home. And she decided after the train had left, she'd call her family, "Some things I don't have to practice. I'm expert at it." She'd call them and tell them she'd take the morning train. She checked her bag in the overnight locker and decided, which way does your nods go? Left, right, or up? Well, that depends on if you're a nodding acquaintance, nodding off, or nodding some other way. Personally, I've sometimes wanted to go to Nottingham. Now, she called home and her mother answered, and she said that the train had left, but she'd get on the morning train. And she said, "I've checked my bag and I'm going to go back to the school, but I'll tell you all about it tomorrow night." And the mother said, "Well, what do you mean?" She said, "I don't know yet, but watch tomorrow's paper." And she couldn't figure out what she meant by those remarks. But after a few more minutes of talking, she went back to the nurse's home and slept the night in her room and woke at 6 a.m., got dressed, signed out again, and went and got a newspaper at the corner store. And it said the train that she refused to get on leaves the track at Little Falls. Many other passengers and crew members were killed. It went across a highway into a rock embankment. The cars were ripped open. This is a young lady who, when she got a premonition, she stayed with it. Now, there was another young lady . This was 1953. She agreed to babysit the small daughter of a couple she knew. She got to their home on 44th Street. This was in Cleveland, Ohio. Sat down on the couch and proceeded to do her. She was in the 8th grade. This was her homework. Well, she began to have a weird, uneasy feeling. So she put her homework aside, and she couldn't understand what was causing her to have such unrest. She inspected the entire house, the doors, the stove, any area that might have a hidden fire. And then she felt compelled to go into the baby's room. Baby was sound asleep. But, and she doesn't know why she did it, she picked the baby up. And seconds later, she heard some extremely loud noises. Well, she cut on the lights, and there where the baby had been sleeping was a bullet hole. Well, she called her parents because it kind of upset her. And the father came over and immediately confirmed it was a bullet hole, and to call the parents and the police. Well, the police discovered another bullet was lodged in the wall. And the police discovered the man upstairs, and this was a two-family home, had decided while intoxicated to clean his guns. And in his condition, he wasn't aware that one of them was loaded and had fired twice. So had the child been in the crib, she'd have been killed instantly. So why did the girl feel it necessary to go pick the child up? It was never, ever explained. You know, there are those that believe in fate, and there are those that think things just happen. There was a young lady who, as a child of 10, lived in a city in southern Indiana. And she liked to play with paper dolls. And she named all the boy dolls Leroy. But she didn't know anybody by that name. My nods say yes, my shakes head says no. A spiritual intervention, that's certainly a possibility. But one day, without any apparent reason, she changed the name of all her boy paper dolls to Alan. Now, 100 miles away from where she lived was a young man who 15 years later would become her husband, and his name was Leroy. But in his mid-20s, he changed his name to his mother's maiden name of Allen. So you have to ask yourself how a little girl playing with her dolls knew these things. It makes you wonder. Are certain things fated? There was a young lady who had been visiting San Francisco, and she lived in Nevada City, California, and she returned there on Friday, April 13th, 1906. And the first thing she said is something awful is going to happen to San Francisco. And of course, they laughed it off. And she said the same thing to the ticket agent as she left San Francisco. And he had said, aren't you choosing an unlucky day to travel? Friday the 13th. And she said, no. I think I'm taking a lucky day to travel because something awful is going to happen. Now, she made the comment to her sister that she was so glad to get out of San Francisco, but up until that point in time, she loved being in San Francisco, and they had to pry her away. And she had left without doing the shopping she'd gone to San Francisco to do. And she had stayed in a rooming house on California Street, run by Mrs. Lambert. And when she got up that first morning, she looked out the window and was overcome with cold chills and made the comment, poor San Francisco. She told the rooming house owner about her vision, and she said, when will California be an island? Well, if Schwarzenegger can make a deal for all that sand, most any day. And she said, I have a premonition something bad's going to happen. And Ms. Lambert said, well, I've been meaning to go visit my daughter in New York City. I may as well go right now. And she packed and left. 5 days later, that house was 2 stories deep in the earth. Five days after that young lady's premonition, April 18th, 1906, the San Francisco earthquake literally destroyed that city. Well, it's me, and with that, that what? Anybody see Astro? He's with George Jetson. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. So until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying, have a truly great evening.